From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll learn how Milwaukee parents weigh quality, cost, and convenience in evaluating after-school programs. A journalist and first-time mom finds herself unable to breastfeed and gets judged for it.
People were looking at me like him and me were something that should be, you know, felt sorry for. It's just, you know, that was really, it was a very strange experience for me. And I do talk in the book about feeling like I had a scarlet letter.
A book of prose poetry gets inspiration from an unlikely source, video games of old. And a Lake Effect essayist sings the praises of a beloved summer accoutrement.
It is justly emblematic of pure lassitude. It is connected in the popular imagination with warm, sultry weather, the indolence of summer, and the tender, scented breezes of tropical climes.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for joining us today. In the discussion about how to improve achievement among school students in Milwaukee and elsewhere, there is often a sidebar discussion about how improving early childhood education and after-school programs will impact the equation. That latter area is the focus of some wide-ranging research by the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum, which recently released the results of a study on parental attitudes towards after-school programs in some particular areas of Milwaukee. Annalisa Dickman is research director at the Public Policy Forum, and she's with us in the studio to talk about the findings and their implications. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
What were the key questions you set out to answer with this particular study?
We were looking at neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee that have had some activity in neighborhood development recently, and we really wanted to ask the parents how that activity is impacting their children with regard to after-school programming and what further investments they see would be helpful for the neighborhood.
So these are neighborhoods that have had some positive change in years past?
Yes. We were working with our partner on this project, LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and these are neighborhoods that LISC has worked closely with to do some planning and investments in neighborhood development.
Well, and so why is this particular area something the Public Policy Forum chose to study?
Well, after-school programming is closely related to educational outcomes. And so we've been looking at after-school program quality in the city now for about a year. And this was great to be able to talk to parents kind of one-on-one and see their take on the quality of programmings that their children have been exposed to.
And so this is part of that large – this is one aspect of a much larger project.
Yes, yes.
So what are the kinds of after-school programs that we're actually talking about here?
So we ended up talking to parents from 8 different programs in 5 different neighborhoods, and the programs were anything from standalone programs that attract students from several different schools to school-based programs that really service just the children in those schools. And one program was actually a private child care center that also offered an after-school program for older children.
And you said you did this one-on-one kind of – these were sort of focus group-based surveys.
These were very small focus groups of parents.
Well, what did you actually sit down – when you sat down with them, what did you ask?
Well, we asked them how they chose the program. What were their factors in making a selection on enrolling their student in the program? We asked them what their favorite things about it were and what things they thought needed improvement. We asked them how it had impacted their children and how it had impacted the neighborhood.
So what was the strongest message that came out of these focus groups?
Well, the most striking thing was that the parents really – they could identify what quality meant to them, but quality really wasn't the thing that was the most important factor in deciding to enroll in a program. They were really looking at convenience factors, so location, scheduling, transportation, those sorts of things. Safety was also very important. They really wanted their children to be in a safe place after school and off the streets. And then there was a mix of parents wanting programs to really focus on homework and academic skills, and parents who really thought the programs were an opportunity for their children to experience other things, enrichment-type activities.
Well, and one of the things you were saying just a minute ago was that the quality of after-school programs is linked to academic achievement. Does a focus on academics specifically lead to that, or could some of these after-school programs that have these bigger objectives also have implications for academics?
you just hit on kind of the great debate in this world is there's definitely a split in both the literature and the philosophy of people working with youth on whether the after-school hours should be kind of doubling down on what's learned in school and really trying to get these kids to work on those skills versus the after-school hours being time to allow the kids to explore things of their own interest or things they may never have encountered before. I don't think we can resolve that question yet, but there's a lot of research being done to try and figure that out.
Well, and I wonder if, you know, these the parents that you surveyed, you said that that quality was not necessarily the prime motivator for how they chose the programs that they chose. Did they see being able to choose based on quality as kind of a luxury?
Well, I think that they didn't really look for all the options available to them. So they were focused on choosing a school. Most parents in the city of Milwaukee end up choosing their child's school, whether it's public, private, charter. And so in choosing the school, whether or not there was an after-school program was part of that. But they really didn't say, okay, let's choose a school and then let's choose an after-school program. I'm going to gather all the information I can about all the different after-school programs and figure out what fits my child the best. It was kind of the school came along with the program in most cases. And even when they were in a standalone program, it was often one that they knew of because they lived in the neighborhood. They saw the building. They knew it was in there. Or in some cases, they had been there as a child when they were younger, or word of mouth. But when we asked them about their favorite things about the program or things they wanted change, those things had to do with quality often. So they really liked the staff, or they felt maybe the staff needed more training and didn't have enough experience. Or they really liked the schedule of activities and they really felt there was a breadth of activities. Or maybe they felt like there weren't enough activities. So the things that they talked about when we talked about the program itself were all related to quality.
Did cost figure into the equation versus these other factors?
For the most part, the parents we were speaking with were in programs that were either very low cost or no cost or were subsidized in some way. So most of these parents felt that cost would be an issue for most parents in these neighborhoods and that, a program that was really high quality and thus had a very high cost would not be something that parents in that neighborhood would be able to afford. But they did recognize that quality improvements could drive up costs.
Well, what was their feeling about whether they'd be willing to pay for something like
that? Right. So there was a mix, again, among the parents of whether they would be willing to pay for that. Some of them felt like, you know, if it was a very specific item that they were asked to help share the cost with, they would be willing to do that if it was kind of a nominal fee, whereas others felt that that wasn't really, you know, that programs should be looking for fundraising elsewhere to do that, so grants or maybe government funds to do that.
You said you spoke to parents in five different neighborhoods across Milwaukee. Were attitudes relatively consistent across those five neighborhoods?
For the most part, we tried to look at geographic differences, and with so few, it was hard to find very clear patterns. I think, if anything, the parents on the south side didn't have as much concern about transportation as parents on the north side. But other than that, there wasn't really anything that jumped out at us as a big difference.
Well, and given that you only spoke with parents from these five neighborhoods, I would imagine it's risky to extrapolate too much about attitudes across the city from this data.
Right, right. This is just kind of a snapshot of these particular parents in these particular neighborhoods. But, you know, no one had really asked them these questions before. So they were very talkative. They really wanted to share their opinions. And I think that's lesson number one, maybe, is that anyone that's dealing with families in neighborhoods in the city should be asking the parents these questions because they have strong opinions.
Did anything especially surprise you that came out of this?
Yeah, there was the focus on homework out of a lot of parents was a little bit surprising to me. As we heard from them, it started to make sense. Many of these parents have several children, and by the time they get home from work and they've gotten the children home from the after-school programs, it's dinner time, and then bedtime comes shortly after that, and homework just, you know, adds to the chaos, and they really want the homework to be done. And they felt very adamant that, you know, they should be done with that homework by the time they get home for the day. So it started to make sense the more we heard it. But at first, I was a little bit surprised to see that these parents weren't necessarily interested in sitting with their children and kind of going through the homework with them. There were a few that did feel that way, but
they thought it was more of a role of the after-school program
right.
itself.
Right, right. And some of them did say, you know, my child's so in middle school or older, and I may not be able to help with the homework, you know, so they need to access help from people that have more expertise.
And these are after-school programs that that cover the wide spectrum of ages.
Yes, yes. So we had the median age of the children represented by the parents we talked to was 9, but we did have parents that had children in all ages.
So what do you see as the implications for public policy from this particular facet of this work, if there are any?
The main thing that the parents said that they felt was missing in their neighborhoods was opportunities for middle school children or older children. So the programs seem to be doing a pretty good job of meeting the needs of the younger children in the neighborhoods. But the older children who may not need to be in the program as if it were childcare, you know, they don't need direct supervision for hours every day after school. They need a reason to come to the program. So they need activities that pique their interest, that draw them in, and those seem to be missing a little bit. So not coincidentally, maybe, programs that serve children older than age 13 are not the regulated programs. We regulate programs that serve younger children. So maybe that's where that mismatch comes in.
You said this is a part of this larger project on after-school programs that the Public Policy Forum is undertaking. Where does the work go next?
Our next focus will be on professional development opportunities for the staff that work in these programs or that work with youth. For programs that are regulated, the regulations have turned towards requiring credit-based training or degrees for the staff. And for many of these programs, their staff are part-time workers. So they don't tend to have degrees right now. So we're looking at the supply of those sort of credit-based opportunities across the region, the cost of those opportunities, how many slots are available in these courses, what time of day the courses are offered, things like that. So we can determine whether what we see as a potential increase in demand can be met by the supply as it is now or whether we need to beef up the supply.
Well, we will be looking to hear about that data. Annalisa Dickman, thanks so much and best of luck.
Thanks, Mitch.
Annalisa Dickman is research director at the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. There's a link to the forum's research brief on the quality of after-school programs from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. A writer tries to diffuse some of the strident tone in the debate over breastfeeding. We'll speak with her when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. When we hear the phrase a woman's right to choose, we're often referring to the hot-button issue of abortion. But journalist and blogger Suzanne Barston says increasingly the new battle lines are over breastfeeding. After Barston's first son was born, she wanted to breastfeed and give her son the advantage advocates say mother's milk provides. But her son couldn't latch and, despite what doctors said couldn't be possible, turned out to be allergic to her milk. Barston tried changing her own diet to no avail and finally, reluctantly, resorted to hypoallergenic formula. Her son thrived. Barston relates her experience and the political debate she wasn't prepared for in her new book, Bottled Up, How the Way We Feed Babies Has Come to Define Motherhood and Why It Shouldn't. She tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that many mothers can't or simply don't want to breastfeed, but the growing lactivist movement often makes them feel like failures as moms, as Barston did at first.
The thought of trying it again, of going back to formula, just seemed like ultimate failure. And, you know, everything I read, I kept Googling, and everything said, you know, just keep up with it. There's no way a baby can be allergic to breast milk. There's no way breast milk is the best thing for a child who is allergic. So, you know, in my mind, I thought that was the last thing we should do is try formula. And it wasn't until, you know, a specialist said to me, this is what we need to try. And if it works, then, you know, we can look at our options and see if there's something you can do to keep breastfeeding. That kind of gave me permission to try it. And I never really looked back because once I saw what a difference it was making, it was just clear to me that, you know, I had been letting dogma in the way of what was really best for my child.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that dogma. How did, as a culture, we get into this kind of breastfeeding frenzy when just a few decades ago we were a primarily bottle feeding nation?
Well, interestingly, we're actually still well, I wouldn't say primarily. We're about a 50% bottle feeding nation at this point. Breastfeeding rates are going up. Unfortunately, long-term breastfeeding rates are not. But, you know, within the first 6 months, almost half of us are breastfeeding, even if it's not exclusive, we're at least primarily breastfeeding. But the way we got into this was, like you said, we were a predominantly bottle feeding society for a long time. And the reason this was is because the pediatric community had managed to convince women that their milk was not the best thing for their baby. Formula in the 50s and 60s was seen as this, you know, technological, advanced, wonderful thing that was going to provide, you know, better nutrition than Mother Nature could. And then what happened was there was a scandal in the 70s with the Nestle Corporation. And they went into Africa and basically convinced women, the same thing that they were telling them here, that their breast milk was not sufficient, convinced them to use formula, left the country and left these women in a situation where they had no access to formula, they had no access to clean water, and the results were horrific. Tons of babies died. It was a really terrible situation. Well, back here and in other Western nations, people started getting really rightfully upset about this. But instead of making it into an issue of, you know, corporate greed and misconduct, what happened was people in the medical community who felt like this was a morally wrong thing to do, which they were right, took it upon themselves to start looking into the health effects of formula and figured that if they could make a case that formula was bad for you, that they could really take down the formula companies. So we saw a slew of studies come out around then that were showing that breastfeeding was better for babies than formula. So this has continued because we have science that supposedly shows that there's these immense benefits. Politicians have signed on. There's been a large push within, you know, the feminist community to sort of take back the breast and make breastfeeding a feminist issue as well. So we have all these forces sort of converging and making breastfeeding a health, a public health and a political and a feminist issue. And that's how we ended up where we were.
But what does the science actually show? I mean, you go into that in great detail in the book, showing that, you know, not all of the science is, I don't want to say is there, but it's been maybe interpreted in the wrong way by some of the so-called lactivists.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. You know, it's a tricky situation because the last thing I would ever want to do is suggest that breastfeeding isn't good for babies. It is. It clearly is. However, I think that the studies that we do have, well, first of all, we need to understand that they're mostly associative. So they're not taking two groups of babies and saying, okay, we're going to blindly assign half of you to formula feed and half of you to breastfeed, and we're going to watch the outcomes. Obviously, that's not ethical. So what we have instead is observational studies. So we'll look at what happens to babies who are exclusively breastfed in the long term versus babies who are exclusively formula fed. Problem is, there are fundamental differences between the families who are exclusively breastfeeding and those that are exclusively bottle feeding. Obviously, there's socioeconomic differences, but even beyond that, there's just some very intangible differences between the mothers who are doing both these sorts of feeding. And also, you have to factor in why that baby is being bottle fed in the first place, because if there were health issues that contributed to breastfeeding failure, that may also play into health issues later on in that child's life. So anyway, you have these flaws in the studies. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is even when the studies are as strong as we can possibly hope that they are. So for instance, sibling studies that look at children within the same family when one is breastfed and one is formula fed, which is sort of taking out some of these what they call confounding factors. Even in those, you know, we can see some statistical differences that are significant statistically. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're really significant in the lives of everyday women who live in areas with clean water and good health care. So, you know, if they tell you you have a 50% greater chance of problem X, that doesn't mean that you're 50% more likely to get that problem. It just means that within the pool of people who are going to get that problem, if you are bottle feeding, you have a 50% higher chance. So that pool of people, we might be talking about 3 people out of a million. My feeling is if the differences were that clear, we would be seeing it on a population level. We would be seeing it on an individual level, and we're just not. So I do think that unfortunately we've allowed our exuberance about breastfeeding to really kind of sneak in to the science. And a lot of the researchers who are doing this work also are breastfeeding advocates. And to me, that's a big conflict of interest.
You talk in the book a lot about the argument of moral superiority when it comes to breastfeeding and the the guilt trip that many mothers are put on. Can you elaborate a little bit more about that, especially as related to your own experience? I mean, what were the reactions you were getting from people when you came to the fact that you were going to have to bottle feed your son?
I think for me, because I had an excuse at the beginning, I used that excuse and I didn't get as much vitriol as I probably would have if I had just said, eh, it wasn't for me. So I think, you know, mostly I was met with pity. The pity was really difficult for me to deal with as somebody who didn't feel like I should be pitied. I mean, here I was with this beautiful child who was finally thriving and healthy and everything I wanted in life. And yet people were looking at me like him and me were something that should be, you know, felt sorry for. It's just, you know, that was really it was a very strange experience for me. And I do talk in the book about feeling like I had a scarlet letter, you know, like a big B on me or I guess F for formula feeding. And to hear comments like that really get under your skin, you know, and just, I think, contribute to feeling like you have to make up for it somehow and, you know, be this perfect mother in every other way to make up for the fact that you're not doing what every mother is supposed to give to their child as, you know, the gift of life.
I wonder if the breastfeeding debate is part of a larger cultural conversation we're having about what is motherhood and what is a good mother mm-hmm. versus a bad mother.
Absolutely, I think it is. And I think breastfeeding is sort of what it's all been focused around, that and work. You know, before the argument was always working mother versus stay-at-home mother. And I think that has faded. It's still there, but I think it's faded a little bit and now become how we're feeding them.
Well, as you mentioned, for as much as it is a personal decision, or at least it should be a personal decision, the breastfeeding issue has been made into a public health concern. What's your caution against us making that into a broader kind of national health conversation?
I think there's a lot of problems with it. I think we have made it into a public health issue, which takes away from the personal empowerment and a more feminist point of view of this, of, you know, it's something that women should have the right to do. Instead, now we're taking away the right to bottle feed. And by making it a health imperative, you know, then society can get involved. And I hear this argument a lot, which is, it doesn't matter what's right for the mother. We have to think of the babies. Oh, the babies. And, you know, that's sort of something that gets thrown at me a lot in my hate mail, which I get every day. You know, it's what you always talk about what the mother needs, but, you know, it shouldn't be about what the mother needs. It's about the baby. You have a responsibility to this child. And that's troubling to me as a feminist. You know, I feel like we're veering off into uncomfortable territory that I feel my community has sort of abandoned bottle feeders. And I kind of think it's time for feminists to step up and realize that this is an issue of bodily autonomy. The other side to that, too, is I think by making it a public health issue, we're also ignoring the fact that 50% of us or more are formula feeding, at least in part, 6 months out. So if all of us are using formula and nobody – it's like the elephant in the room. No one's talking about formula or formula feeding or how to safely formula feed. There's mistakes being made. You know, and I personally think a lot of the – I mean, I think they're minor, but the health discrepancies we're seeing between formula-fed and breastfed babies, I have a feeling that if we actually focused on formula education and helping parents find the right formula for their baby, bottle feeding in a – basically a bottle nursing kind of way, you know, learning how to read hunger cues and not overfeeding, all these things that contribute to issues like obesity and ear infections and stomach issues. You know, that's where we can be making some real change. It doesn't mean that we have to abandon our breastfeeding initiatives, but I think if we take it away from this is something that every mother must do and focus more on this is something every mother should be able to do, let's give her the resources so that she can do it if she so desires. But if she can't or doesn't want to, we're also going to ensure that she has all the resources she needs to bottle feed in the safest way possible.
At the risk of minimizing the choice that women should have to decide whether to breastfeed or not, can you explain a little bit some of the reasons why some women might not just be able to, that they don't have a choice for whatever reason?
Absolutely. Well, the statistic is that only between 1 and 5% of women can't make enough milk. Now, this statistic, unfortunately, gets thrown around a lot. It gets thrown in the faces of women who are complaining that they, you know, have tried everything and are driving themselves crazy trying to make enough to keep up with their baby's needs. And they're told time and time again, it's not possible if, you know, it's such a small percentage. Well, if you think about how many babies are born every year in America alone, let's say even if it's only 3% of women who can't make enough milk physically, that is still thousands, tens of thousands of women who are suffering from this issue. And on top of that, this statistic comes from one study that was done, I think, in, I want to say, one of the Scandinavian countries years ago. It doesn't even have anything to do with our population. It hasn't really been backed up by any other study. It's really just an assumption and I think a bad one. So that is for women who do not produce enough milk. Now, on top of that, we also have babies who have latching issues. We have mothers who are on medications that do not mesh well with breastfeeding. You know, we're getting more research saying that it's safe, but not every woman feels comfortable with the amount of research that's there because we just haven't had these drugs around enough to have good long-term info saying that they're safe. So, you know, that puts women in an odd position, too, to try to make that decision. Then there's women who have suffered sexual trauma or sexual abuse. This can make breastfeeding really uncomfortable and difficult and triggering. Some women who have had this experience find that breastfeeding is really healing and empowering, but a lot of them don't. And again, they're ignored in the breastfeeding literature and told that this is a way for them to heal. Or I've heard from women who have said that, you know, when they told their care providers that they were sexually abused and they don't feel comfortable breastfeeding, they have gotten comments like, well, you know what? If you're healed enough that you were able to get pregnant, you should be able to breastfeed.
Wow.
So there's, you know, there's a whole laundry list of conditions.
And your experience, even in writing this book, was that there really aren't these resources available for mothers who either can't or choose not to breastfeed. That's how we got bottled up.
Yeah, there really are no resources. And I get questions every day that I'm not comfortable answering because I'm not a doctor. And it's really sad to me that, you know, I become like the one go-to for bottle feeding advice when, I mean, where are these people's pediatricians and nurses and lactation consultants who are charged by the boards that govern them? They're supposed to be offering education and advice for bottle feeding as well. And they're not. You know, instead, I hear from moms who said, well, I call my lactation consultant and said, I've decided to start supplementing. How do I do this? And they basically get told that, you know, they can't help them and that they're making the wrong choice. Instead of that health professional accepting that that parent has made a decision and giving them advice to help them do it in the safest way possible. So, you know, the fact that a blog written by a journalist has become a resource for health advice, I mean, that should tell people that things are really warped. So, I mean, currently I'm working on an initiative to work with hospitals and breastfeeding centers and mothers groups to try to get some of this information and education out there to new moms, because we can't, you know, ignoring bottle feeding or pretending it doesn't happen isn't helping anybody. And until we can have statistics that show that, you know, across the board, 100% of women are breastfeeding successfully, we have to address these concerns, you know, and we have to make sure that women are getting the information and fathers are getting the information that they need.
Well, Suzanne Barston, thank you so much for coming in and sharing Bottled Up with us.
Thanks for having me.
Suzanne Barston is author of the new book, Bottled Up, How the Way We Feed Babies Has Come to Define Motherhood and Why It Shouldn't. She writes and edits for health and parenting publications and writes the blog Fearless Formula Feeder. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Wisconsin poet B.J. Best's latest collection takes its inspiration from an area some might think of as decidedly unpoetic. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. If you're a listener of a certain age, you probably recognize the theme from the classic video game Super Mario Brothers. You'll also probably get the reference in the title of poet B.J. Best's new collection of prose poetry called But Our Princess Is in Another Castle. It's a refrain that comes on the screen after each of the first 7 levels of the game is completed, one that frustrated millions of kids in the 1980s and 90s. Best harkens back to the heyday of arcade games and video game consoles like Nintendo and Atari as the inspiration behind these poems. They might seem less highbrow than the literary allusions of Keats and Whitman, but Best believes that this art form was ripe for Mario-esque plumbing. And like the universal appeal of Tetris, he tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce, the collection has something for everyone.
The book overall is a book of prose poems inspired by video games, and each one is titled with a classic video game. It's important to know that the book isn't written about the games, and therefore my intent is that it can be enjoyed by people who have played these games and who grew up in the 80s and are real familiar with them, but also by people who aren't familiar with any of the games.
Why did you feel that these games made for good material, good metaphors for some of the themes of growing up, love, losing love, finding yourself that you're exploring in this book?
You know, the old adage is write what you know, and that means you need to consider what you know. And, you know, a large part of my own growing up was, in fact, playing a lot of these games, and it doesn't immediately seem like it's good material for art. But when I went back and started kind of replaying these games, the thing that struck me about them was simply how weird a lot of them are. Like, they have all these things that simply don't make sense. And we'll go back to Mario for a second. So Mario is a plumber, and he is in a kingdom that was once ruled by mushrooms and has since been taken over by turtles. In order to get power, more powerful, he eats a mushroom and then he eats a flower. Like, none of it makes sense. And it's especially true for, like I said, the classic video games, where all these kind of incongruous details are just thrown together. But the result is something kind of magical as a result. And so thinking about it for the book, it was really cool because since the narratives of the games don't make sense, it's easy to pick out the things that I thought were interesting and try to build my own narratives off of them.
You talked about the fantasy, the fact that in so many of these games, the narrative, if there is one, doesn't make sense. And I thought that was such a good analogy for what it's like when you're a kid looking at the world growing up. And certainly the first few chapters in the book, you know, reflect that idea.
Yeah, the cool thing about being a kid is that when you're a kid, you're kind of open to wonder and magic wherever it shows up. And like I said before, certainly video games offer this magic, this kind of magical experience. But you can find it anywhere. You know, you find it playing out in the woods and, you know, digging around and building a fort and pretending. Or, you know, I've got a 3-year-old son at home right now, and it's amazing what he enjoys pretending. You know, one moment he's a conductor for music and he's got a baton, and the next moment he's a fireman and he loves sliding down poles, whatever he thinks is a pole at the time. And so because we're more open to the ideas that things don't need to make sense and that we can be one thing at one moment and one thing at the next, I think video games play really easily to that, where you can be a plumber in Super Mario Brothers and then you can be this hero in The Legend of Zelda and wield a sword, and it's all just part of your experience.
Many of the poems are also looking at love, burgeoning relationships. And I mean, some of them, man, just punched me in the gut. I have to say, Psalm, GoldenEye 007, mm-hmm. and Asteroids, those were two that to me just kind of stuck out. And yet they're very short, very terse. And yet you maximize the effect of the words by that simplicity of language. Is that something that you can only get through prose poetry?
Well, on one level, it's that compression of language is what you get through any poetry whatsoever, right? Because the art of, you know, I think it's Coleridge who says poetry is the best words in the best order. What I like about prose poetry is it actually kind of lulls the reader into a false sense of security, because a lot of people aren't real comfortable with reading poetry, especially contemporary poetry. You know, a real common complaint is people say they don't get it for whatever reason, and that it doesn't appeal to them and they avoid it as a result. And it's true. I mean, the poetry's audience in the world today is very small, unfortunately. What I like about prose poetry is that if you put some paragraphs in front of someone, they're a lot more comfortable. They're like, okay, paragraphs. I know how to read this. I've done this before. And it offers an opportunity, an artistic opportunity that way, because it's an opportunity to do something surprising. And for me, a good prose poem does something surprising with the language that a normal paragraph that you'd read in a nonfiction book or a newspaper or something like that doesn't do. And it's an opportunity to offer more surprises and sudden twists in subject that technically if you're writing a 5-paragraph essay, for example, you're never supposed to do. And so that's what I like about the tension of the prose poems. And again, it works well with the idea of the video games because all these details don't make sense. Copying that and kind of adapting that for the poems themselves, I think works effective way.
Well, and additionally, in many of the games, they're very episodic, which really works for prose poetry, which is kind of little vignettes, if you will.
Definitely. And the whole book is kind of arranged that way. It's mimetic of video games in the sense that a lot of them are divided up into levels. And here in the book, there's eight different sections, and they're all, you know, they're short. They're between 6 and 7 poems long, and that was all very intentional to kind of say reading the book is also kind of like going through a video game.
One of the themes that's also running through all of these levels is this idea of self and identity and finding oneself. And I also kind of find that interesting if you take it from the meta level of looking at this as being a gamer is such an identifier in our culture today.
I mean, what I think is most interesting about these games is that they force you to take on a different identity whenever you wind up playing them. And it's become especially true with the advent of the entire genre. It's known as a first-person shooter. And it's developed as the idea that you are the person. And literally, when you're playing the game, what you see is a hand holding a gun, usually. And that means that you are the person actually doing it. And it becomes a really odd dislocation of identity as a result, because you're never you in the game. And the characters are developed more or less depending on the exact game that you're playing. But the games are forcing you to take these different roles. And the interesting thing to me about that whole shooter genre is that in the real world, you would be a mass murderer. That is what you would be. And yet it's common and accepted that you are the hero and you're going to kill hundreds of people in order to save the world. And you're only going to do it more or less by yourself. And so it's this kind of fantasy that some of these games put forward, that you are the hero, you're the only one who can save the princess or, you know, defeat evil or whatever. And so it's kind of aspirational in that way, because isn't that in some ways what we always want to be in life? We want to be the hero. We want to be, you know, saving the world. But obviously it never works that way. And the other interesting thing about identity with video games is that the heroes often fail. You die in video games a lot more than you actually succeed and win overall. And that idea of resurrection is really interesting too. And so playing these games does dislocate who you are in favor of someone else. And I think that's very interesting. And as I said before, you know, the poems themselves aren't inherently autobiographical, although I weave in plenty of my own biography to do it. But I thought it was really interesting to kind of explore, you know, who are these speakers if they're couching so much of their lives in the details of the games themselves.
How did you go about writing But Our Princess Is in Another Castle? Was this an idea that had been rattling around for a while? Is it something you sat down and you said, you know what, I'm going to go through all of these games, and inspired by these games, I'm going to write these pieces? Or did you find yourself using some of these references in your poems already and go, oh, here's a great platform through which I can approach these poems?
It was an intentional starting point. And actually, it's weird to think of playing games as research. But that's honestly what I had to do, was go and play some of these games, because I hadn't thought about them or seriously played them in a long time. And when you're playing and thinking about them in terms of what can I use them for in order to write my own poetry, you're thinking about them in a very different way than, oh, I'm just going to kill 10 minutes or an hour, you know, kind of enjoying myself playing some of these old games. So I started playing them, looking for those odd details that I talked about previously and seeing what might trigger me. The interesting thing about this project is that it actually does speak to a much older tradition, and it's known as ekphrastic poetry, which is poetry in response to art. There's plenty of famous poems out there. One really famous one is by Anne Sexton. It's called Starry Night, after the Van Gogh piece. Really, I view this as kind of ekphrasis for the 21st century, you know, using video games as the source of art, even though it's pop art, and drawing from them and building my own work off of that.
Going off of what you just said, using the video game as art, this is a great moment to have you talk about Tetris as inspiration.
Sure. The poem's called God Plays Tetris, and it's irreverent, you know, in certain ways. In some ways, it was spurred on an article I read. The article claimed that, and they did the math behind it, that you can never win Tetris. No matter – you cannot play infinitely on Tetris. The way the program is written, the combination of pieces will always, always, always make you lose. And so I thought, well, that's not terribly optimistic. And so for thinking about the faith chapter, I thought, well, what would God do in result to that unfortunate bit of knowledge, knowing that no matter how powerful you are, you can never win the game? And so that's kind of where the piece began. I just kind of took it to some logical conclusions based on there, and it kind of had some fun along the way. You know, it's funny to imagine, you know, the classic question is, can God make a stone he can't lift, and that sort of thing? But no matter who you are, even if you're God, you can't beat Tetris.
Well, let's hear that.
God plays Tetris. His machine is immaculate. Gold and titanium, diamond resistors, and a seraphic hum while running. but the program, invented by Alexei Pajitnov and ported to the arcade by Atari in 1988, is the same. The first levels are mindless, and he drops through them with zen. Then, disembodied blocks, but it's easy, building towers with a dark canyon on one side, occasionally eroding it with the one straight piece. Soon, the shapes drift from verga to flurries to snow. A mislaid piece and he can still recover without grace. Then muttering, I'll put this square here, thank you. No, I don't want another six of those orange S-shaped pieces. Damn it, I just need a straight one. Which either does or does not come. His omniscience is useless. Towers become ugly, jumbled mountains, hard and fast. He has made mountains before, and he has made floods, but his past sins will not wash away. He is drowning in squares. This is what it must feel like. He loses, beats the side of the machine with his palm, wonders why he gave them free will. Well, it's not just this, but a lot of things. Unhip, weary. Then he exhales a laugh with a thin smile. He had forsaken Russia many years ago, so lurid. Those creepy nesting dolls, any czarocracy, vodka, that Siberian nothing, communism, unnecessary quantities of potatoes, backwards R's, atheists, and garish spindled minarets, no holy man would enter.
Excellent. I want to have you talk about the final poem.
Sure.
In the book, Congratulations, Enter Your Initials, which if anyone who's played these games and actually gotten to the end, despite hours and hours lost in your basement playing these games,
right,
you will see this if you got a high score.
Right. Yeah. It's one of the few poems in the book that's not deliberately titled after an actual video game. But it was super common in the arcade games, especially. You put a quarter in, and if you did well enough, you got to enter your initials. And this is back when arcades were public places, or otherwise these games would show up in bars or pizza parlors and that sort of thing. And it was an honor. You could enter your initials in, and then they would keep flashing up on the screen every minute or so when nobody was playing, saying that you were one of these people. You were one who managed to master it at this particular location, obviously until either the owner unplugged the machine or somebody bumped you off. And so, the final poem kind of speaks to that idea that we all want to make our mark in some way, even if the mark is about something small and even if it's something that in the grand scheme of life isn't that much of an accomplishment. But we're constantly seeking out that recognition for whatever we do, even if it's something small and plenty of people might consider it trivial. But it also speaks largely to the competitive aspect of video games. A lot of single-player games, you're competing against the computer. But if you've ever played a game with somebody watching over your shoulder, all of a sudden you're trying to show how good you are to that other person.
Breaking every brick for those extra 50 points.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And so – but isn't that the way life is in a lot of ways, too? We work harder when other people are looking, too, and then we want to come on radio shows and talk about the things we've done as well.
Well, BJ Best, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about But Our Princess Is in Another Castle.
Thank you very much.
Wisconsin poet BJ Best's latest collection is called But Our Princess Is in Another Castle. He also has two previous books of poetry and three chapbooks and teaches at Carroll University in Waukesha. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce in March. A Lake Effect essayist looks to one of the most anticipated parts of the year for him, a time when he can just hang out. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Memorial Day weekend is just about here, and with the weather forecast to be generally nice, Lake Effect essayist Richard Hederman is thinking about the upcoming season, which most of us think of as summer, but he thinks of as hammock season.
Work is good for you. It strengthens the body, focuses the mind, purifies the heart, and elevates the spirit. I wouldn't know this from personal experience, but it's what I've always heard. In the all too brief and fleeting months of summer, I spend a lot of time in my hammock, considering work and its dubious virtues and diligently pondering how it is best avoided. And while we're at it, let's consider that the word work falls neatly into the four-letter word category, meaning that it is likely distasteful and probably dangerous. Few are the contrivances so invite such joyous abandon to sloth and indifference as the hammock. It is justly emblematic of pure lassitude. It is connected in the popular imagination with warm, sultry weather, the indolence of summer, and the tender, scented breezes of tropical climes. Everyone has a vision of a rope hammock slung between two sloping palms at the edge of a bathwater-warm Polynesian lagoon of purest turquoise. Simply put, it is at once an austere yet luxurious berth in the wind. But don't underestimate the humble hammock. Make no mistake, it has a history. Indeed, its origins go back to pre-Columbian antiquity. The word hammock comes from the Taino people of Haiti and their word hamac, meaning fishnet. You might imagine some enlightened soul following a long day of fishing, flopping in a net that had been hung up to dry. One may well see then how the connection of the hammock with leisure formed and spread with abandon. It is no accident that hammocks likely originated in a hot climate. It's hard to imagine them being invented in Finland, for example, as they are eminently practical in the jungles and rainforests of the world. In suspending his bed above ground, the inhabitant is thus better protected from venomous serpents, ants, tarantulas, and other creepy crawlies, and even the occasional flash flood. Columbus first saw hammocks in the late 15th century on the island of Exuma in what we now know as the Bahamas and introduced them to Europe when he brought several back to Spain. Hammocks have long been employed by explorers or soldiers traveling in warm, heavily wooded regions, and indeed their connection with adventure is well established. Who could forget the hammock celebration of intrepid endurance on Gilligan's Island, a portrayal that made you want to be marooned on an uncharted desert isle just so you'd be joyously compelled to life in a hammock? The British Royal Navy formally adopted them in 1597, and they proved highly effective in the crowded depths of 17th and 18th century naval vessels, which packed increasing multitudes of cannon. Unlike wooden bunks, in battle, hammocks could be quickly taken down or tied up and stowed, and didn't splinter dangerously when shattered by cannon fire. At sea, hammocks traditionally served as burial shrouds. A dead mariner might be sewn into his hammock with a weight of shot, and after his obsequies had been duly recited, sent over the side and committed to the deep. The hammock proved ideal in the time-honored maritime practice of hot racking, assigning more than one crew member to a berth or rack to reduce space. Depending upon the watch system, two or even three crewmen could end up sharing the same hammock. In hot racking, it is likewise a simple matter to turn a lazy sailor out of his bunk. A hammock can be easily tipped with one hand or sent to the floor in an instant with a slash of a knife. My wife and I have been careful to avoid hot racking by maintaining separate hammocks and thus preserving marital harmony. The naval use of hammocks continued into the 20th century. During World War II, troop ships employed hammocks to increase available space and troop carrying capacity. Many leisure sailors even today prefer hammocks over bunks, since a slung hammock moves in concert with the roll of a seagoing vessel, the occupant stays well balanced in rough weather. Hammocks have also been employed on spacecraft, notably during the Apollo program when the commander and lunar module pilots slept in them between moonwalks. They're also particularly useful aboard submarines where maximization of space is critical. My own connection with the hammock is storied and cherished. My hammock is a harbinger of summer, coming out of storage upon the first run of fair weather in the spring, and by mutual agreement doesn't come down until after Election Day. My wife gave me a new hammock a few years ago, and I wasted no time testing it exhaustively, rating it for stability, lift, comfort, and support, all the virtues that have made underwear a success since probably the Council of Trent. And indeed, hammocks can be just as personal. I found the hammock's generous latitudes, provision of weightlessness, and suspension above this careworn globe to encourage an exploration of the many questions central to human cognition. Is there a God? What are our moral responsibilities in the face of an amoral culture? Is true justice possible? And how do you keep your beer from spilling if you fall asleep? Hint, take a tennis shoe with you into the hammock. Wedge it next to your leg and put your beer in it before you nod off. So the next time you spend an hour or two in your hammock, instead of mowing the lawn, rest assured you're not shirking. You are part of history. Here's my poem, Hammock Season. Housered in this languorous snare, I'm lolling in summer's blue estuaries, breaking the sky's miraculous code under the eyelid's revenant eclipse, where July's fireworks flower. Indolence is the virtue of those suspended, slumped in the sag of slumber. How easily my vocabulary yields to the z's of idleness. Doze, daze, drowse, and laze. I've grown the pelt of the sloth and can no longer grasp the yard rake or the hoe. Let the compost go unturned, the grass become deep as a bed. Let the employable and the conscientious ruffle and fuss, for I am weightless with the gods of the sun, nodding like a sunflower in the breeze. And when the muse arrives, tell her to come back when I'm not so busy. This is going to take a while.
Lake Effect essayist Richard Hederman is a poet and writer. He lives in Wauwatosa. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. So glad to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.